is all attacked. If I'm mostly right about this peculiar set of interconnected circumstances which led up to the first industrial revolution, the first capitalist society, and so on, why did it happen? Why should it happen there, not in France or Spain or Japan or anywhere else? And here I think you need to look at all that I've looked at historically, and that is the frame. My jigsaw puzzle now has a frame around it, and we're starting here. We'll end up there. We start down here with the Anglo-Saxons. The Anglo-Saxons were the people who came to England after the fall of the Roman Empire in about around 500 AD. So they dominated England with the Vikings for about 500 years. And they were a special people. They were unusual people. They were a rural people. They lived in small villages in the countryside. They were cattle herders and farmers who lived in small villages. And Marx himself says that the rural love of in England, the rurality of England, which he noticed, came out of this early Germanic tradition of not really liking towns. The Romans loved towns, the Germans loved the countryside. So they were country people. They were commercially minded people. They bought and sold their cattle. They became engaged in. In fact, capitalism, the word comes from a word meaning cattle. And they became traders. They had a particular kinship system, which is the one I have. It's called technically in anthropology an Eskimo kinship system. And it's one which has a certain kind of way of thinking about your relatives, your descent. You trace your ancestors through males and females at the same time, unlike China, which just does it through males. You call your relatives. You classify, put all the arms together and uncles together and so on, so on. The whole kinship terminology, what is called the descent system, how you were descended, and the inheritance system is Germanic, and it's the one that was given to us, and it's very different from the Roman one, which traced descent through males and not through both sides. And the Roman one gave great power to the father, patriarchalism. Whereas the Anglo-Saxons didn't give power to either the male, dominant male, or to the father. And the Roman one set up households, which were also economic units, mixing the two together, and gave automatic rights of inheritance to children. The Anglo-Saxon one system didn't give that. The Romans had hierarchical legal statuses. You were born a slave, a commoner, or a nobleman. The Germans didn't have any of that in their legal framework, or a little bit of the beginning, but it soon faded out. So you had the very permeable, this is 500 years of English history, you had a very easy set of ladders up and down which you could move. The Romans had a sophisticated written legal system based on a set of principles. The Germans had a system of judges who went round village, called together the villagers, and they acted as a jury who then tried people. And the German law was based on what previous judges had said, precedents on spoken language rather than written. The Romans had a top-down, then by the end of the Roman Empire, it was a dictatorial system, an emperor. The Republic had disappeared. And so it was centralized and very autocratic dominant. The Germans, in their conquest, had operated a very loose or feudal system where you gave a lot of land and power to people below you, you gave land and power down and down and down and over. So the center was just rather relatively weak and depended very much on people below. So it was a pretty democratic system. with meetings of the local leaders together with the prime leader. Now, this system, which came in after the Roman Empire, if you this system, which came in when the Germanic people came down here and conquered Rome, it spread over much of, went right down to Italy and Spain and France, Germany and England. The Germans who came here came down from this area. And if you looked at that, the world of European or about 1100 maybe, about 900 years ago, you would have seen it all rather similar. It was all this kind of description I've given you. The Roman Empire collapsed. There were shreds of it remaining, but it was mainly a Germanic feudal civilization that existed here. So England was not so very different from anywhere else. It was in many ways modern, in my definition, in that there were powerful churches. There was the church, there were the nobility, there were the kings, and there were the towns. And they were all growing, and they were all roughly equally powerful all over this area. So there was a separation already to a certain extent. And so a traveller through Europe in the 11th century would have said, well, it's, you know, it's all going to be modern, probably, I mean, if they thought in those terms. But from the 12th century, that's from about 1150, 1200 onwards, something strange happened. This is all mapped out in one of the great books. Often people say it's the greatest history of Europe, although it was written mainly in the 19th century by man called Guizot. He was a famous French politician, but he was also a great historian and the teacher of Tocqueville. And in his History of Europe, he very briefly explains what happened, which was a great divergence. This has been a phrase used in relation to China recently, but there was a great divergence in Europe. Because in England, this kind of civilization, this Germanic civilization I've described to you with Germanic language, Germanic law, Germanic kinship system, this all stayed very, very strongly here. It was an island separated off by the sea. So it remained like Charles Darwin's Galapagos Islands. It was inhabited by a species of animals which stayed in their normal state there. But over this whole area, right through the rest of Europe, as Giza shows, this didn't happen. Almost all of continental Europe moved through a set of tendencies which are normal in human civilization, which is that you get through warfare and competition a tendency towards the concentration of power. All power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, as I've quoted before. You get a tendency towards centralization of power as societies become richer and as they compete with each other. War, above all things, as Montesquieu and Tocqueville pointed out, lead to the centralization of power. What happened in almost all of Europe was the state and the church came together. They formed an alliance. So from about the 12th, 13th century, you have, in France, you have the great crusades against the southern heretics, the Albigensians here, led by French kings in collusion with the papacy. And they destroyed these people, they killed them all off. And the Inquisition is formed, and the alliance, what's called the Caesaro Papist, the Caesar and the Pope, come together in one unity to rule the rest of the population. So you get the development of the Inquisition, the Jesuits, the formal alliance of church and state. Secondly, you begin to get more and more the Roman idea of the separation of social groups. You get blood becoming more and more important. You get nobility, who are now blood nobility, who you can be a nobleman only through birth. So you begin to get what Tocqueville documents, a caste system. You were born into a caste. You were a peasant, you were a townsman, you were a nobleman. Much of this is given legal reinforcement and indeed is expressed and confirmed by that central thing which I've talked about, the law. Because what happened was from about the 14th century, down in Italy, which obviously had retained Roman institutions the most, they started to revive in Padua and other Italian universities. They revived Roman law. They revived not just early Roman, the Republican law, but the late laws of Justinian, which was the law of a dictatorial absolutist Roman civilization. These laws were revived by these university academics and others. And of course the kings in Germany and France and so on were very, very happy to enter into an alliance with these lawyers, because the lawyers were saying, you are the king, you are supreme, you are an absolute monarch, you are the emperor. You are like the late Roman emperors. Other people were keen on this because the lawyers were saying, you are a nobleman, you have birth rights against the population. Males were happy to hear this because this was a patriarchal legal system which reinforced the power of fathers and males over the rest. So you get from about the 14th century through to the 16th, 17th century what is known as the reception of Roman law. In other words, Roman law is received and put into practice all over most of Western Europe. But it doesn't cross the sea. This keeps Germanic Anglo-Saxon law, common law. Little bits come. There are civil lawyers in England, which civil law means Roman law. So little bits which are useful are tacked onto common law. But on the whole, 90% of all this stuff, including the attitude towards the king, is not accepted here. The kings are not emperors. Fathers are not superior over their children. So you get an island of law, as one of our great legal historians has put it, John Baker, which is entirely different from anything here. So the reason for this difference is something I've alluded to before, which is really very simple and was pointed out by John Miller, in the Scottish philosopher in the 18th century, which is that here you've got, say, something which might end up as France, down here, Spain, Italy, Germany, other countries here, and so on. There is no fixed border between these places. There is nothing to stop someone from here coming and attacking you here, and so on. So this Western Europe is a constant battlefield between different areas which are trying to build up their power. And the result of that is that a person here who sets himself up as the king, armed with this new legal system, can put huge pressure on the population, because he can say, if you don't support me, I won't defend you against these people. So you must pay very, very heavy taxes. You must come and fight in my armies. You must obey me. If you're nobleman, you must come to my court and behave. Otherwise, you'll be dead. I'll just... So basically, there is a growth of control. This is a point that's made very forcefully by de Tocqueville in relation to the reasons for the decline of democracy. He says that if a country has land as borders, then you have the threat of war, and war constantly creates absolutist political system. He says the great benefit of America is that it's an island, in a sense, when he would have visited it in the early 19th century. England was an island until really the First World War, and we began to realize that as soon as you have a war, then it justifies the central government to get rid of liberties, alter the balance of power. This is why, since 9/11, the whole situation in the world has changed in America, and in the war, supposed war against terror, it justifies all sorts of anti-liberal activities. So, all this area, being a continental country and with these pressures, developed in one direction. So Europe turned into a vast peasant-based civilization with a huge gap between the literate and the illiterate, the town and the country, the rulers and the ruled. This is because of the question of boundaries and borders. These people had to keep a standing army to fight against these opponents, and therefore they had to have heavy taxes, they had to have large bureaucracies. And so towns were tipped against population. This meant that this is the second period, the medieval period. So at the beginning, Europe is very similar. During this period, 1000 to 1500, is the great divergence. If you like, if you could, put it in a different diagram and just say that, in a sense, England went roughly in the same sort of direction, and Europe was, the rest of continental Europe was the same, and then, depending on how you look at it, either Europe went up like that or Europe went down like that. They diverged around 1200, 1300, and continued to diverge, so that by about 1500, people, travellers who came to England, and I use quite a lot in the book, which will come out of this series, people said, we're coming to a strange country, they do odd things here. There was a growing sense of oddness about England. It was more peaceful, it was richer, but in many ways the political system, the social system seemed odd. And then, so that's the end of this period, and then what is called the early modern period, the 1500 to 1750, the oddnesses increase. The tendencies towards absolutism, towards the 18th century, absolute monarchs, increases in Europe. And universities decline, many civil society declines, etc., etc. England becomes an outward-going trading empire and develops in an entirely different way. And this forms the foundation, it becomes wealthier and wealthier, so that by the time when the English Industrial Revolution really begins to take hold or starts in 1750, it is very, very different. This divergence has grown more and more and more. So that even by 1700, when Voltaire, Montesquieu, others came to England, they said famously, we have come to a country which in no way resembles the rest of Europe. It's free, it's got political liberty, it's got religious liberty, it's got social mobility. And as you know, the inspiration for the French Revolution and for the American Declaration of Independence and so on came out of witnessing what England was like around in 1700 and 1750. It was quite clearly, both to Frenchmen, Germans, the Scots, a new kind of civilization had been born. And by the end of this century, or a little later, England was beginning to control a quarter of the population of the world through its empire. Now, doing that is not an easy accomplishment. I've argued very strongly, and I warned you that I put arguments very strongly, said that you react and think, I don't know, you must. Can't be quite like that. I have simplified enormously, and the detailed evidence will be in the book that comes out of the series. But that roughly seems to me to be the picture. And I've argued strongly that it was an accident, a chance. There was nothing particularly good or moral about the English. They were very lucky to live on this island. But their luck shaped the world you and I live in. If there had not been, if we return to the metaphor of Rostow and the airport, the English went along and then took off, the aeroplane took off in the 18th century, and we have our modern industrial world. If that had not happened in England, there was no sign that anywhere else was going to do this. It's not just a matter of, oh, well, it wouldn't have happened in England, it would have happened in Germany then, or Japan then, or something. There was no sign that it would have ever happened. It was a total accident. England was large enough, free enough, rich enough, and practical enough to escape from a number of very, very powerful tendencies and traps which stop agrarian civilizations. Population, which I haven't gone on about much, predation of the rich on the poor, growing inequality, growing absolutism. Most of human history is a story of constant crushing of development. And England was extremely fortunate to be able to escape from that without anyone being able to stop them. They managed to stop smaller places like the Italian city-states in the 15th, 16th century, the Dutch, whatever. The English managed to do it. And what, of course, they produced is the world we now live in, which is in many ways produced from England, many of the things, the language, the games, the democracy, and so on. But they've produced a world which has a particular history, as you've seen, Christian, based on Greek and Roman philosophy. And this has now come into close contact with much older and greater civilization, namely China, which is based on entirely different premises, Confucian and rice cultivation and so on and so on. And this is the fascination, what will happen when China, once again, because for most of history it has been the dominant civilization, when it fuses together with this something, this stream coming from a different set of mountains. I mentioned the Yangtze before. So the European civilization and England have flowed down like this, and the East Asian civilizations have flowed like that. We're now all one river. And I think I'm optimistic after this visit, as I have always been visiting China, that you have enough validity, civilization, gentleness, and tolerance to lead the world into new pastures, as they would say. So I wish you all success in doing that, and thank you very much indeed for listening to my lecture.